Temeraire had got 3 deer, despite their springiness, and felt rather pleased with the world until Lawrence came back from the house pale and refused his share of dinner.
"I'm very happy the house is not burnt up,"
Temeraire said to him anxiously, as they made ready to get under way, wondering if something else, perhaps, had happened, if there were some damage which he could not see. Lawrence paused and looked over his shoulder. Temeraire looked too, and thought the house looked very like a jewel itself. The pale yellow stone glowed with light, warm and inviting, coming out of so many windows in so interesting a variety of shapes, all the dozens of intricate towers and ornaments in perfect order.
"I will never come here again," Lawrence said, and pulled himself up the harness. "Let us be away."
It was all of a piece. Lawrence was not himself at all, and Temeraire was increasingly certain they would never make matters right this way. They had taken no prizes whatsoever all their long weeks of raiding. The French soldiers had nothing but the food they had stolen, not even a cannon or a flag to be proud of, and if ever any more suitable battle offered, Lawrence would insist on their flying away at once to hide. What battles they did have were over very quickly. Poseidon had devised a method of tearing up tall yew trees with bushy tops and smooth long trunks, and dragging their crowns along the ground during a diving rush. It was most convenient. The soldiers could simply be swept away by the dozens, and the branches sheltered one from the musket fire, so there was no risk at all. The chief difficulty was to keep the men from scattering, and it felt rather unpleasant and odd to be chasing anyone so very small who would just as soon have run away, even if, as Massoria explained, they would only regroup and go stealing again. It was not the sort of fighting Temeraire had looked for, even though everyone else seemed to approve.
"Where is the rest of the army, I should damn well like to know? But at least you fellas are showing the frogs what for,"
one stout elderly gentleman said, thumping his stick on the floor for emphasis. They had stopped a raiding party outside a village in Derbyshire, and the children were brought out to see them all. A few of the older boys, very bold, came running up to touch them. One put his hand on Temeraire's foreleg, and then stared up large-eyed when Temeraire peered down at him in interest, and said, "Hello." The child ran away very quickly.
"Chinese children are braver," Temeraire said to Lawrence, "but I'm glad that these are getting a little better and coming to see us. I suppose it is because we are being heroic," he added interrogatively.
He was hopeful that if this was not very interesting fighting, at least it was the sort which government would like.
"Their parents had done better to keep them locked away," Lawrence said without much emotion. "Will you look over the maps with me?"
So it certainly made Lawrence no happier, although Temeraire did not perfectly understand why Lawrence should insist on their fighting so if he did not approve it himself. Since they had seen Woolerton Hall, however, he seemed all the more fixed upon his course.
"I fear it is the unhealthy climate and the diet of this country," Gong Su said. "No one could be well, eating in such an unbalanced way."
"But we do not have much choice what we eat while we're at war, and I cannot do anything about the climate," Temeraire said.
"Too bad," Domaine said, rather indistinctly.
He was not enjoying his first British winter, and snuffling almost continuously into his sleeve. Sifo was not suffering, or rather not in the same manner. He was regularly bundled into every spare piece of clothing which Domaine could find, and now wearing 3 shirts, a knitted waist, 2 coats, a boat cloak, a hood, and a hat, crammed down upon it all, could scarcely move from where he had been put down near the fire. Roland was sitting with her arms curled about her knees.
"It is not right," she said. "I don't mean we oughtn't to be stopping them, but we ought to be letting them surrender when they see us, and taking them prisoner, although I don't know what we should do with them. I wish Mother were here," she added desolately.
Many of the other captains were also dissatisfied. The very next day Temeraire overheard Granby speaking with Lawrence in low voices, and then Lawrence said,
"Captain Granby, I hope you know that you may transfer to another station at any time you wish. I would not keep anyone at this task against his will."
"Why, damn you, Lawrence," Granby said, and walked away.
"Of course Granby is not happy,"
Iskierka said, yawning, when Temeraire went so far as to ask her.
"I am not happy either. This is all very boring, and we have no treasure. But it is still better than just carrying soldiers about, or patrolling. At least we're doing something, and it is orders anyway, which you ought not question," she added.
Temeraire put back his ruff. Farmers now slaughtered their own cattle, if they heard the French approaching, and poisoned their grain. Villagers in makeshift armed bands ambushed soldiers while they slept, and one foraging mission after another returned to their encampments empty-handed, when they returned at all. An unwise outpost commander, sorely pressed, at last made the mistake for which Lawrence had been waiting, and sent out his dragons to hunt for themselves. The farms immediately around their encampment had already been depleted, and the beasts separated to look farther afield.
"There are nine. Two of those big grey ones, and the rest are all smaller, with three only a little bigger than I am,"
one of their small spies informed them.
"The big ones went alone, south, and the others went towards a town north-northeast with a red steeple, and parted there."
Lawrence nodded, and Gong Su led the feral to his reward, a portion of mutton stewed with rabbit, which the little dragon tore into ravenously. The supply of meat was growing increasingly thin throughout the countryside.
"I'm sure we can beat seven dragons," Temeraire said, his ruff already excited and his tail switching.
"We are not going to fight seven," Lawrence said. "We are going after the chevaliers."
He laid out his map quickly and showed them all. A large estate lay some 3 miles south of the outpost, with a dairy. They kept high over the cloud cover and emerged only just above the estate. The petty chevaliers were yet on the ground, eating. It had likely been a few days since their last meal, and they were trying urgently to make up for it. Two carcasses already each lay stripped down to the bones, and they had moved to thirds. Their crew had dismounted and were, with similar energy, ransacking the dairy house.
"Those are milk cows," Domaine said indignantly, peering down at the dragons and their repast.
His own people were great herdsmen, and valued their proper husbandry high.
"Signal the attack,"
Lawrence said, and Temeraire, roaring, plummeted with the rest. The chevaliers panicked and flung themselves aloft instinctively. One leapt, only to meet Maximus's full weight upon her back, and bellowing dreadfully was driven down, straight down into the ground again, and with a snapping crack went silent. Maximus staggered off and shook himself, dazed by the impact. She did not move, and her captain, crying her name, flung himself heedless across the field towards her. The other chevalier managed to beat a little farther aloft, and shouldered past Chalcedon's eager but over-optimistic attempt to repeat Maximus's feat, bowling the yellow reaper over. But Ischierka was lunging with ferocious glee, and a torrent of flame engulfed the chevalier's wing and neck.
"Ow!"
Chalcedony said, barely dodging the edge of the flames himself.
"You needn't hit me! We'll get out of the way, then!" Ischierka
called over her shoulder, already pursuing the crying petit chevalier, whose hide and tender membrane showed the blackened and scorched marks of her flame. The dragon was trying to come back around. His captain was yet upon the ground, and despite the wounds, the dragon would not abandon him.
"Je me rends!"
the captain cried from the ground through a speaking trumpet. He was waving a white handkerchief furiously.
"Je me rends!"
It was the only hope for his dragon. Lily was winging in from the other direction, and Temeraire hovered aloft. The reapers in a group had barred every point on the rose. In a moment they would bring the petit chevalier down. For a moment Lawrence did not move. A heavy weight was difficult to manage. Their orders. Then he said,
"Mr. Allen, signal Captain Berkeley, take charge of prisoner. Temeraire, tell that dragon to land there by those trees, and keep away from his captain."
The rest of the French aviators backed away as the dragons came down and fled into the dairy house and the woods behind. The dead dragon's crew dragged their captain away, the man weeping openly like a child. Lawrence looked down at the misery and hatred in their faces, turned briefly up towards him. The French captain submitted to being bound, and while his dragon called to him anxiously, was put aboard Maximus.
"Is he fit to fly, Berkeley?"
Lawrence asked.
"I'm only a little jarred," Maximus said, trying to nose at his own chest.
Berkeley's surgeon Gators was already palpating the massive ribs with his hands, carefully in either direction.
"I do not believe there is a crack," he said, "but a few days' rest."
Berkeley snorted.
"After this? Not unless we were in Scotland. They will be out in force after us." "No,"
Lawrence said, still cold.
"They will not. They cannot afford it."
In the morning, the first reports came from their little spies. The French heavyweights were retreating south towards London, forced back into territory under more thorough French control, where their hunger could be satisfied. Slowly after them, the rest of the combat weight beasts also melted away, more every day as the stores depleted, until nothing remained but the small couriers. Now the infantry were exposed, unless they kept in their encampments and did not stir out, in which case they would starve. A few large bands went out with artillery, but could not find enough for all, and in desperation soon broke into smaller parties for foraging. These were at their mercy. Blue pins for the small French companies daily marched across his maps, back and forth from their encampments. One by one they were plucked out and laid back into their tin, and Lawrence rinsed blood mechanically off his hands at the wash-basin. Very little thought now was required, and he was glad of it, distantly. Their own supply gave them no difficulty. If they landed near a town or a village, meat would somehow be managed for them and the dragons, cows or pigs or mutton, even if the villagers themselves went hungry as a consequence. Occasionally the French tried again a pursuit, orchestrated from farther south, but so much early warning reached them they had merely to draw back a little and let the dragons sleep, while a flock of little ferals kept watch. They had been raiding then nearly 2 months, when Arcady arrived the first week of March in a great flurry of noise, carrying Tharkay and with 3 of his ferals for escort, and at once began to parade before Temeraire and the others to tell them of his adventures since their last meeting. He had only been patrolling with the others, but by his account he had fought hordes of French dragons and captured many prizes, and he bragged that they would do well now he had come to join them, at which news Temeraire laid back his ruff in irritation.
"I have a message for you, from Wellesley," Tharkay said to Lawrence, and came inside with him.
The implacable maps were laid out upon a makeshift table, a door laid over 2 old trestles inside the small cottage where he had sheltered overnight. Tharkay stood in the doorway looking out, while Lawrence opened the letter. Their camp was a strange, silent place. No prisoners but the one solitary French officer, the captain, desolately sitting outside a hut with his hands loosely tied and bound to a stake in the ground, under guard by a couple of Granby's bellmen. The massacred trees which the dragons used for their sweeping were in a great heap at the edge of camp, and the dark, bare branches darker still with dried blood, a forest's graveyard. Every man went about his work silently and without either fuss or satisfaction. They had killed 50 men that morning. Wellesley's new orders were not very different. He only directed their efforts more particularly towards the eastern coast, and carefully avoided any word to suggest what those efforts should be. All was left unstated, and Wellesley closed by saying,
"And you are welcome to this jabbering creature and his fellows if you can make better use of them."
"Very good," Lawrence said, setting it aside.
He drew out the map of the North Sea coast to consider it. There had been some raiding near Stickney last week, and an outpost near Cromer, one of the places the Fleur de Nuys would likely be landing with fresh troops when they could get across.
"They must send out foragers there 2x a week," Lawrence said to Tharkay. "I will send you there with Berkeley, and free the rest of us to go after them at Stickney. If you begin near the outpost and circle outwards, you are likely to find the foragers soon enough. There ought not be more than 50 men. They have stopped sending out larger bands. Berkeley will approach from their forward direction, and you will cut off their avenue of retreat."
"I beg your pardon," Tharkay said. "I prefer not."
Lawrence paused, his hand arrested mid-air above the map.
"Arcady, I am sure, will oblige," Tharkay said. "But someone else must captain him, I regret," he added with a lash of irony. "I have not the luxury of setting aside, for a time, the veneer of civilization. I must be a little more careful. A temporary viciousness may be pardonable in a gentleman, even admirable, but it must brand me for ever a savage." "Lawrence, what are you doing?"
The question was simple enough, and ought to have afforded any of a dozen answers. One after another presented themselves for his consideration.
"Killing soldiers," Lawrence said at last, "most of whom are starving, and making them vicious, so they give us still better excuse."
It had the poor advantage of being true. Giving it voice, Lawrence tasted all its ugliness on his tongue. He sat down and put a hand over his mouth and found his face was wet. He could not speak again for a little while, struggling to master himself and his voice. At last he said to Tharke hoarsely,
"If you will not, what will you do?"
He did not mean the question in the immediate sense, and Tharke did not take it so. He shrugged in his restrained way, the movement of a hand only.
"There is work enough in the world," he answered, "and little enough time."
"And no one to decide but yourself,"
Lawrence said.
"No authority but your own conscience."
"There are authorities to choose from," Tharke said, "to suit any action, if you like. I prefer to keep the choice a little closer."
It seemed to Lawrence the most miserable, solitary existence imaginable, isolated by more than distance or even disdain.
"How do you bear it?
The choice and all the consequences thereof, alone."
"Perhaps use has reconciled me, or," Tharke said dryly, "perhaps I simply have less natural inclination to hold myself responsible for the sins of the world, rather than for my own."
Lawrence covered his face with his hands a moment, and shut his eyes against the filtered reddish light. The hayloft smell of straw, and the vanished horses, warm and familiar, and the sulphur bite of the dragons outside. Wood smoke and Arcady's smug prattle, broken occasionally by Temeraire's more resonant protests.
"Very well," he said,
and went out, leaving the orders upon the table.
Chapter 15.
"Forgive me," Lawrence said.
Temeraire had settled himself for the night, curled up comfortably in an old, well-ploughed field behind the barn, fallow now and full of soft, dry grass underneath the snow. They were alone, or nearly so. Domain and Sifo and Roland and Alan were all tucked into the curve of Temeraire's haunch, under a little lean-to which Domain and Roland had worked out of a tent and a few sticks, and rigged to Temeraire's side, as it was warmer to sleep against him, so, than in the tent alone. But all four were fast asleep. Arcady at last had stopped telling stories, and was now busily making up to Ischiaca to sleep near in the heat she gave off. Temeraire had sniffed a little in disdain, and curled his own tail about the lean-to, just to be sure his crew would sleep warm and dry besides. He did not at once understand what Lawrence was apologizing for, until Lawrence had explained a little.
"Forgive me," Lawrence repeated. "Bad enough that I used myself so. To have used you likewise is unpardonable."
"But Lawrence," Temeraire said, at once glad and baffled, "it was my fault, surely. It was my notion we should go to France in the first place. Only I did not know that they should take your capital and your rank, and I am sorry."
"I am not," Lawrence said. "I should give more than that, and count it cheap to preserve my conscience. I am ashamed to have submitted to despair so far as to ever have thought differently."
Temeraire did not wish to argue in the least. Lawrence sounded like himself again, if still drawn and perhaps unhappy, and that was worth anything. But privately he could not help a certain resentment that a conscience seemed to be so very expensive, and yet had no substantial form which one might admire and display to one's company.
"But," he said heroically, "I did mean what I said, dear Lawrence, about the talon sheaths, and I do wish you may sell them and buy some new things for yourself. I would like my conscience to be just as clear."
Lawrence said, with even a touch of amusement,
"I am sorry to have neglected my coat, if it has given you so wretched a notion of my finances, but I am not so wholly impoverished."
More gently he added,
"There will be no more pavilions, I am afraid, but I hope I need not be an embarrassment to you."
"You should never be,"
Temeraire said, and nudged Lawrence with his nose. Lawrence stroked his muzzle.
"I do not know what our course will hereafter be," he said. "I owe apologies more than this, and must make them, and then I must write to Wellesley. I know not how, but I must tell him we will not continue in this manner.
There will be no more of this slaughter without quarter. We will manage our prisoners somehow, and we will rather seek out than flee any force which has a gun or a few dragons."
Temeraire had not known how worried he had been until the source of the distress had lifted, but his spirits rose almost effervescently at Lawrence's words.
"How happy I am to hear it," he said, adding, "and I am sure we will take a great many prizes."
However brave a face Lawrence wished to put on it, Temeraire felt this could not but be reassuring.
"More likely," Lawrence said, "Wellesley will order me to come back and be hanged at once."
"If he does, you shall not go,"
Temeraire said indignantly, flaring his ruff.
"No," Lawrence said after a moment, "I shall not. Sir, I must beg your leave to acquaint you with an alteration in the methods of our company, to which I hope you will not object, for humanity's sake, despite some increase in inconvenience and in danger, which all those officers in His Majesty's service presently reporting to me, and those dragons likewise, have gladly agreed to support, venturing rather their persons than their conscience."
Along these lines the letter was written with difficulty, and by Gurney it was sent. They established their new camp between North Seaton and Newbiggin-by-the-Sea, and began to put up a stockade manned with volunteers from the countryside.
"We are making a nice honey-pot for them to rescue,"
Sutton commented, as the dragons cheerfully tore up trees. They had no guns to defend the walls.
"Then at least they will have spent the time and effort to come for them, which they would otherwise have used to bring fresh troops over from France,"
Lawrence said. In any case, no one objected. It shamed him again to see how greatly the other officers and dragons both were relieved by the alteration in their practice. He expected daily, however, an answer from Wellesley, relieving him of the command, and wondered what he should say to the other captains when it came, if Wellesley should have found some other officer to carry on the work. But no letter came. 3 days later a great noise arose in the morning around their camp, many ferals bursting in upon them eagerly with news, and before their combined chatter could be worked out, the great dragons of the corps were already landing everywhere, laden with men. One company after another were put off onto the ground, supplies, artillery, and the dragons leapt away again with scarcely more than a call of greeting. Above them, more dragons were flying past. All the British army on the move. Wellesley arrived at a little past noon and commandeered the old half-derelict barn, where the crews had been sleeping, for his headquarters.
"Out, the rest of you!"
he said, jerking his head at the crew and even the aides sweeping out the floor, fixing Lawrence in place with a cold look.
"Cleverly done, Lawrence," Wellesley said when they were alone.
"Not so simple after all, are you?"
Lawrence was silent, uncertain, until Wellesley added,
"I will not waste my breath asking who on my staff passed you the news, but you will understand me. If you have the infernal gall to waste my time now with some damned attempt at extortion, I will shoot you myself."
And then Lawrence understood. Wellesley thought his letter had been timed deliberately, on the very eve of his southward advance, to establish Wellesley's own responsibility for the slaughter of the French irregulars.
"I will not hear a damned word about pardon from you," Wellesley said. "Not a one. In 3 days' time we will meet Bonaparte, and if I win, no one will give a damn whatever accusations you like to make. And of course," he added icily, "you will be well looked after in the event we lose."
"Rowley!"
he bellowed.
"Get my desk in here and call in the general staff."
Officers began to pour in, struggling under tables and maps and chairs. Lawrence was almost at once pressed away from Wellesley as they thronged around him, and any reply Lawrence might have made was lost in the crowd. He felt the urgent wish to push through, to seize Wellesley and to argue, but he forced himself to be still. It did not matter. He could make no denial Wellesley would believe. In any case, that Wellesley thought him a blackguard for refusing to continue rather than for having begun at all made little difference. Lawrence had earned the condemnation, and he might as well bear it for the wrong cause.
"Emily,"
he said, turning instead and beckoned her back into the building. He was peering in at the door cautiously to one side of the stampede.
"Take Domain and go up and get those hayloft doors open," he told her, "so Temeraire and the other dragons can hear."
He went outside himself. It was already becoming impossibly cramped upon the ground, though more trees had been uprooted, and a broad avenue opened up to the road. Every dragon who had landed, dropping off men, was soon jostling for space at the hayloft.
"We shan't manage like this," Jane said,
Exidium having landed after a warning hiss had cleared him a place.
"Dragons over the rank of lieutenant only may stay. The rest of you must go on with the rest of the army and get the news from your officers or your captains. We have had to give them all ranks, thanks to your Temeraire's splendid scheme," she added dryly to Lawrence. "The rest of them turned miserably sulky and wanted epaulets of their own, frivolous creatures."
She patted Exidium, who looked rather smug with two epaulets of deep fire orange to match the edges of his massive wings. They had scarcely made a little order and themselves crammed back into the barn before Wellesley began. His aides put up a map of Chatham Roads, the mouth of the Thames where it spilled into the channel, with all the small towns and villages thereabout. Their positions were marked, and a low murmur went about. Their backs would be to the sea.
"Well, gentlemen, I see you like our position as well as I hope our friend Bonaparte will do," Wellesley said. "The Navy and the Corps have all but cut off his connection to the continent, and the countryside has risen. He loses now each day 100 men, and each week 2 dragons for lack of supply. He can ill afford to refuse us a pitched battle if we offer it to him on what I trust he will think reasonable terms."
The terms seemed indeed reasonable, from the French perspective. Lawrence wondered if Wellesley meant by such an arrangement to stiffen the backs of the soldiers by denying them any avenue of retreat save through the French troops before them.
"Colonels Featherston and Bree, you will take the centre. Your position is the most essential. You must hold until you are signalled," Wellesley said. "Yield before the moment is ripe, and he will split our forces and destroy us at his leisure. You are not to advance under any circumstances. You are only to form square and hold. Colonel Rethlow, you will back them with the artillery. The cavalry will take position on either flank, with the rest of our infantry positioned here and here," he indicated, "and the corps will hold off any French attempt to charge our centre from aloft. All our design, gentlemen, as I hope you gather," he went on, "is to hold fast while they spend the best part of their strength and divert their attacks from our centre until the signal is given. The order of march then being sounded, we will gradually withdraw along either flank."
Two of the aides heaved up a fresh map with new positions marked, yielding to the French the very centre position which had been so vigorously defended,
"and cut him off from his aerial support and whatever reserves he may have yet kept back, and launch our attack against his rear. General Paget, it will be your task to ensure that Bonaparte himself remains within our circle. General Ollen, your artillery will be directed towards Bonaparte's reserves, rather than the main body of his force, to keep them from rejoining him. Our aim, gentlemen, is the capture of this tyrant, and an end to his perpetual war. I will be satisfied with nothing less, and I assure you their lordships have agreed with my judgment."
With only this brief and unsettling plan of battle, he concluded and dismissed them all, adding,
"Colonel Featherstone, a word with you."
He drew that officer aside privately, thus preventing many other officers of the general staff who themselves plainly wanted a word, and more than one. Lawrence went out to Temeraire, who was rather regretfully submitting to being rigged out in carrying harness.
"We are taking this company," he said as Lawrence came, "or so he tells me."
The infantry officer nodded to Lawrence a little stiffly and touched his hat.
"Very good,"
Lawrence answered, and stifled his doubts. To risk dividing their forces so, yielding the centre to Napoleon, and then directing all their force deliberately between him and his reserve, to be pounded upon from either side, seemed a terrible risk to run. If it made more likely Napoleon's capture, it made also more likely that the French should simply overrun them. But Wellesley was not a fool, and if he meant to tolerate all the weaknesses and dangers of his planned course, he had some cause. He had certainly taken pains to evade any questions, and any protests which might have been made against him to the ministers, by delaying the conference until the deployment already had begun. There was nothing for it now but to trust him. The degree of excitement which Temeraire felt expressed itself nearly as pain. His ruff expanded whenever a few minutes passed where he did not make an effort to smooth it out, and drew a pounding tightness all along the line of his neck. He tried now and again to curl himself for a little rest, but it was impossible. No more of wretched raids, no more hiding, no more carrying anyone about, a real battle at last. Their coverts were established also on the coast, but well to the flanks of the battle, to north and south. Temre could see the dotted lines of fishing huts scattered away around them, a few distant yellow candle gleams, and the rocky coastline a dark mass against the faintly lighter sky, the steady ongoing roar of the surf behind them. It was yet dark. The voices of the Fleur de Nuit scouting their positions echoed overhead. Occasionally a flare was shot off to blind them, or a few dragons chosen by lot went up to chase a few of them away. Lawrence rose a little before dawn and climbed down from Temeraire's back to look out towards the battlefield.
"Is Napoleon there?" Temeraire asked Lawrence eagerly. "Have they come?"
"Yes," Lawrence said. "They are in pickets. Put your head down and you will see them."
Temeraire lowered his head and dipped it so he had one eye aimed along the ground. Against the deep grey of the sky, as it lightened, he could see atop a hill the tiny narrow lines of the pickets. Narrow posts, little more than sticks, each leaning a little in one direction or another, and the lumpy, dark shapes at their base, the sleeping soldiers thus kept in their columns. Overhead the stars were dimming and going out, a thick grey fog rolling in from the water as the sky grew paler.
"It is time," Lawrence said.
Fellows stirred behind Temeraire's leg and, yawning, rose to see to the harness. Temeraire rumbled softly, deep in his throat, and called,
"Majestatis! Ballista! It is time to get everyone up!"
"I still do not like this plan at all,"
Pasitia said fretfully, as they all ate. Fresh cattle saved for this morning, and nearly everyone had all they wanted.
"I do not see what the use is in fighting so hard to keep them from the centre, and then letting them have it after all. Why not give it to them at once to begin? And are you quite sure they are there?"
The question was not as odd as it seemed. The fog had grown so thick they could see nothing from the ground but the trees just about the clearing. The presence of their own army had to be taken on faith, much less the enemy.
"Yes, I am quite sure," Temeraire said. "Lawrence pointed them out to me just before morning. We will see them better once we are aloft, I am sure."
Rain fell in a thin, icy drizzle as they went up. They had all drawn lots to see who should have which shift, as Admiral Roland had insisted they might not all fight at once, and Temeraire did see the sense in keeping some back, when the battle should be very long. He was very relieved to be leading up the first rank, however, and hoped, privately, that the fog might last, and perhaps Lawrence would not notice when it was midday and time for their own rest. He could not, after all, see much better from above. Pockets of mist, like seething cauldrons, stood in every low valley, and still more great, towering clouds were rolling majestically in from the sea, so high they stretched up to engulf him as much as the ground below, with gusts of sharp rain that pattered noisily on his wings. As they flew on towards the battlefield, he began to catch glimpses of the soldiers in their companies on the march, all arranged a little differently, like patches of cloth in odd sizes, some long as ribbons and only 5 men across, others great massed bodies upon the field. All rippled smoothly over the ground, columns of white and black and blue and red on either side, gliding up over the hills, down again into the valleys to be swallowed up in the fog. Even then he could still hear the strange noise they made marching, less a thumping which he might have expected than a regular hissing, as their clothing or their boots brushed against one another with each stride. The wet ground muffled their steps. The trumpets sounded a joyful, encouraging noise no matter who had blown them, and the cannon spoke in orange flame to announce the battle had been joined, somewhere. The French dragons were somewhere farther back, Temeraire supposed, peering uselessly. Trees lashed with fog banks barred his view of the French rear.
"There!"
Lawrence called, and Temeraire followed the line of his arm to see their own centre established. Temeraire was pleased that, to his eye, their own force was much the handsomer. A great many of the Frenchmen he could spy wore long drab coats with scarcely a touch of colour, and otherwise were largely in white breeches and white shirts, none too clean, Tamerere noted, with very ordinary dark blue coats. He much preferred the vivid red coats which dominated their own army. They had also several companies of soldiers in the centre in colourful and patterned skirts, instead of plain breeches, and, of course, their flag was by far the more interesting.
"And if they do have eagles," Tamerere said to Lawrence, "all the better for us to take them away. Lawrence, do you not like those skirts they are wearing over there?"
"Those are the Scots Greys Cavalry," Lawrence said, looking through his glass, "and those are the Coldstream Guard beside them. If anyone can hold the centre, they will. But good God, Bonaparte will pound them without mercy."
"We will keep the dragons off," Tamerere said. "I am only a little worried that at the end we are meant to encircle Bonaparte and not his aerial support. What if Lien should escape?"
Privately, Tamerere felt it was rather peculiar to take so many pains to capture Napoleon and not so Lien, who was a good deal larger and possessed also the divine wind.
"Let us hope to have such success as will make that a matter for concern," Lawrence said. "But if Bonaparte is taken, she will surrender, I expect, although she may realize she cannot be held hostage for her behavior in the usual manner."
"Here they come,"
Magistratus called, wheeling around. Through the sheen of rain, Tamerere could see the dark shadows of the French dragons coming. Below them, the front lines of the British infantry began to form into their large, bristling squares to receive the charge. Soldiers stood shoulder to shoulder, facing outwards upon an open centre. The front rank knelt with bayonets outward, the second aiming over their heads in parallel, and the third pointing upwards. Long pole arms were thrust deeply into the ground just behind them, steadied by their bearers, the gleaming broad fan-shaped blades straight up, and the narrower pikes angled backwards to catch any dragon attempting to strike at the line of the square from behind. The French dragons were coming with bombs and nets, however, to try and overcome such measures. They had also stolen Posidius' trick of uprooting trees, which they plainly meant to use broom-like to sweep gaps into the squares at a distance.
"Now, Tamerere!"
Lawrence called urgently, and Tamerere dashed ahead to meet the French skirmishers, roaring with delight. There was a roi de vitesse coming out of the fog. He was armed with a tall, if slender, birch tree, white and bare-branched, clutched a little awkwardly in his talons. He dived to avoid Tamerere's charge, making determinedly for the front lines of the first square. His crew fired a spray of rifle fire up at Tamerere's belly as they passed. A quick, hot sting of pain. He had been hit. But Tamerere sniffed when Lawrence asked. It was nothing. Nothing at all. He threw himself over with an elegant corkscrewing twist and plunged low in pursuit of the smaller French dragon. Dimly he was aware of the bayonets looming ahead, gleaming and silver as the fog swirled away from them, and Lawrence saying something to Demain about the bombs. But the French dragon filled all his view. Oh, it was very quick. But Tamerere stretched his wings, cupped all the air he could, and flung himself after. He would not let it at the square. He would not be outrun. And with a lunge he had got near enough to put his claws into the other dragon's tail. The roi de vitesse squalled and tried to jerk away. Tamerere set his talons and beat backwards furiously, while over his shoulder a couple of small bombs were lobbed at the French dragon's crew as they tried to bring their rifle fire to bear again.
"Tenez bon!"
the dragon cried to his crew, at once squirming to throw off the bombs and flailing away with his tree as best he could manage with Temeraire's grip upon him. Temeraire only just stifled an undignified yelp as the treetop fetched him a sharp slap across the neck and belly. The branches were springy and stung painfully, but he kept his head despite the very unpleasant sensation and managed to seize hold of the tree in his jaws and wrest it away. Disarmed, the French beast gave over his attempt at last and flew away hurriedly for the safety of his own covert, his bleeding tail dripping behind him.
"Ha!"
Tamerere called after the vanquished, curling his talons about the trunk, and he lashed the air with the tree experimentally a few times.
"Lawrence, perhaps we might go at their ranks with this,"
he proposed over his shoulder. He could see a company of French soldiers advancing slowly from the mist, and he was quite sure the tree would answer nicely in reverse.
"We must stay near the squares," Lawrence answered, "and not advance. Pray call those reapers back on your left. They have already let themselves be lured too far."
Tamerere sighed a little, but he threw the birch tree into the sea and turned to corral Chalcedony and the others. They were all darting at a grand chevalier, lunging in at her head and nipping at her flanks, but the big dragon, rather than turning on them in earnest or fleeing properly, was slyly retreating, little by little, luring them back towards the French lines so the smaller dragons could slip past and make their attempts against the squares.
"You are meant to be an officer. It is your duty to keep everyone else from flying off,"
Temeraire said sternly, when he had rounded them and they were all flying back towards the squares.
"Well, Cantarella has the epaulette,"
Chalcedony said, a rather craven defence.
"Oh!"
Cantarella said, and nipped at the edge of his wing. He yelped and twisted away.
"Very well, then I am in command now, and you have all heard him say so,"
she declared, and hitched her epaulette forward. It was a bit sodden with rain, but still notable against her pale yellow and white.
"You may be sure I will not let us go afield again."
They did not have to go afield anyway, to have all the fighting they might want. The French were coming steadily after them, and Temeraire wheeled to meet them with a will. By midday they were driven farther aloft. The French had established an artillery emplacement at the centre, despite all the British artillery could do against them, with a shield of pepper guns and several of the cannon elevated to strike at any dragon dipping low. The air was colder and cleaner as they rose out of range, and more clouds streamed past to divorce them from the noise and fury of the battlefield below. Their own struggle was quieter, the whistling air and the muffling clouds stealing all but fragments of roaring, and the occasional pop, pop of rifle fire. The French had abandoned their trees and netting, proven to encumber them too greatly against a determined aerial defence. Lawrence felt rather discouraged than pleased, however, by the speed with which the experiment had been adopted, tried, and cast off. He could feel Temeraire's energy flagging. They had been fighting now 6 hours, and there was little chance to pause and rest. Many of the soldiers below were lying upon the ground, out of the way of cannon fire. Wellesley had ordered they might do so when not themselves engaged. There was nowhere similar for the dragons to land except the coverts where they had slept a mile away. Behind the British lines there was only the roar of the sea, invisible beneath the blanketing fog, and on either flank the cavalry horses stood nervously shifting, pawing at the dirt. The French had abandoned cavalry entirely. It ought to have given away an advantage. Dragons could not be risked on charges in the face of artillery, as the cold calculation of warfare would allow an individual horse to be, and the British horses were all hooded now, blinders cupping their eyes, so they could only see straight ahead, with sachets of fragrance over their nostrils, so they could not smell the dragons. A little past noon, Lawrence heard the drumming of the first charge below. The heavy cavalry were splendid in their rush, all of them shouting furiously and waving scimitars, the standard flying out behind them. They were sent at a battalion of the French infantry, a manoeuvre to gain some breathing room. Nearly every French company now was pressing steady fire against the Coldstream Guards, which Napoleon had surely identified as the linchpins of the British centre. The French battalion did not break. Instead they formed square themselves, but a peculiar square, double size, with a great empty gap in the centre. The cavalry committed to their charge. They were flying across the gap, in the face of the steady musketry, horses falling with terrible human shrieks, men flung off and crushed beneath the hooves of their own mounts.
"Lawrence, where is that Poudriciel going?"
Temeraire said urgently, pointing. One of the small, drab French dragons had broken away from the skirmishing and was diving quickly towards its own lines. The Poudriciel landed directly within the French square, and doing so brought to vivid life the relative nature of size. The Poudriciel were a lightweight breed, just barely combat weight, and this one perhaps 6 or 7 tons only. It yet loomed hugely over the ranks of soldiers, great taloned claws flexing behind the silver rows of bayonets, roaring with its red mouth full of teeth. Even hooded and with their noses full of perfume, the horses would not run directly at a dragon. The cavalry charge wavered and broke. The horses' necks were bowed deeply or pulling frantically away to either side as they fell to a stumbling gait fighting the reins. One, out in front, and recoiling too late, slid off its hind legs as it came too close. The Poudicier leaned over and snatched the horse bodily off the ground with one clawed forehand, shook the rider unceremoniously off onto the ground, and with much enthusiasm opened its jaws wide and took off the flailing horse's head with one bite. The French dragons had likely been on short commons a while now. The effect upon the remaining cavalry of the pitiful sight was pronounced. The horses were given their way, wheeling away back to the British lines, never having come within 10 yards of the infantry square at all. The Poudicier leapt away again as soon as the cavalry had fled, before British artillery could be brought to bear against it, having had a little rest and a little supper besides. Farther to the rear of the French army, Lawrence saw more of their dragons were dropping down for a similar rest, out of artillery range and amidst the infantry companies who did not flinch.
"Well, I do not need a rest," Temeraire said bravely. "And if I did, there are Ballista and Requiescat coming now with a fresh shift. I suppose I would not mind setting down for just a minute, perhaps," he added, "and a little something to eat."
"I think we cannot," Lawrence said grimly. "He is sending in his reserves."
The fog was thinning now a little, blowing away from the land, and far to the rear of the French lines dragons were leaping into the air one after another. And now the advantage would tell. None of the French dragons, with their short and frequent rests, were withdrawing. There would be no rest for Temeraire or any of the British dragons who had been aloft and fighting since first light. Temeraire pulled up very short, abruptly, so Lawrence was flung against his leather straps. A determined crowd of 6 little gardes de lion, pouring fresh into the field, had charged him in a body, and now began shrieking in exaggerated voices and belabouring his head and neck wildly, batting with wings and claws. Temeraire backwinged with 2 mighty strokes and roared to scatter them, the tremor of the divine wind knocking them back. But in those few moments the enormous Grand Chevalier they had seen earlier came crashing past and threw herself down at the square of the Coldstream Guards. The pikes and bayonets were stiffened, but she did not come down upon them directly. Instead, she struck the ground directly before the front ranks, so heavily many of the men were flung off their feet, and turning round, roared full in all their faces. It was a moral assault only, but a dragon the size of a large barn, roaring less than 10 paces away, might make the bravest man blanch. Bayonets wavered and dipped, and then 20 riflemen stood up on her back and fired a terrible and concentrated volley into the stunned ranks. A knot of men fell altogether, opening a vulnerable gap in the wall of the square, and she thrust her massive foreleg into that open space and swept it along the line, all the way to the corner of the square, crushing and knocking down men and pikes like so many blades of grass. Temeraire roared furiously and dived towards her, but one of the gardes de lion flung itself into his path.
"That," Temeraire said furiously, "is quite enough, and anyway the soldiers are smaller still than you."
He seized the little dragon's neck in his jaws and with a jerk of his head broke it, a single dreadful snap. He let the beast go falling out of the sky, a little scrap of scarlet and blue, the small handful of crewmen scattering like falling leaves through the air behind. The garde de lion had bought the necessary time with its life, however. Below, the Grand Chevalier had gotten herself off the ground again, and with an escort of joyfully roaring pêcheurs and poudriciels, was ponderously flying back to the shelter of her lines.
"The coward,"
Temeraire said bitterly, watching her escape into the range of the French artillery. The square was trying desperately to reform, some soldiers crawling back to their places on hands and knees, too dazed yet even to stand, dragging their muskets along behind them. Lawrence heard the horns blowing, a thin and thready sound, and everywhere the French were suddenly advancing. The knot of fishing huts on the left flank, so long hotly contested, now came suddenly under a savage bombardment. The fresh dragons coming in flung themselves over it, casting down loads of munitions, until at last a rush of infantry poured over the low encircling fences and charged into the huts one after another, and black smoke came out the windows as the British colours came down. If they meant to give the centre up, it must be soon. But Wellesley gave no order. He was observing the battle from a ridge on the right flank where a few tents had been erected for the headquarters. At the moment he was looking out to sea, gauging perhaps the weather, which had begun at last sluggishly to clear, before sweeping his glass back towards the French rear. Lawrence followed his line of sight with his own glass, and saw, in the thinning mist, Napoleon's standard, and the Emperor himself in his plain grey coat and black hat, mounted on a white horse and backed by the gleaming and polished ranks of his guard. Even as he watched, Napoleon raised a hand and, with a single economical gesture, sent 10,000 men in motion. The word ran along the French lines, and one after another of those marshalled companies began their steady march forward into the British centre. The Emperor himself turned towards the fishing huts just taken, and the guard followed in steady ranks as his command shifted forward. On either flank, the dragons of the corps were fighting fiercely to hold off the advance, but they too were tired. On the right, Axandard, the great Flamme de Gloire, loosed a torrent of flame against Lille's formation, and Lawrence, to his horror, saw Massoria recoil, her wing blackened and smoking. She did not fall out of the sky, but reeled heavily against little Nitidus, fouling his flight, and a few men, specks of black, went tumbling down through the sky. Two of Axandar's wingmen darted in to press the advantage, borders leaping across to Lily's back. She twisted and plunged, trying to shake them loose, and in the opening a spectacular honneur d'or, gold and blue and red, went through the shield, diving towards the massed ranks of British cavalry with a great roar, his crew firing off flares from his shoulders as he went, spreading his wings wide. The horses shrilled and bucked in terror, and stampeded madly straight ahead, pouring in a mass into the open field and providing the French with their bodies a shield against the British artillery. The advancing ranks of the French infantry broke now into a steady jog, their bayonets fixed low as they came, and back over the French camp dragons formed into line, heavy weights and middle weights, with a screen of light weights and courier beasts before them, and all together began a slow, measured advance, one wing beat after another, inexorably.